You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We're on Twitter, as always, at KUOW. And we're about to talk about sexual abuse. And I really hope you're not reaching for your radio dial right now, because that's part of the problem. Seattle's mayor has quit because of allegations that he sexually abused teenage boys decades ago. Murray denies those allegations. This is beyond this one case. This is a crisis that maybe you'd rather not face. Couldn't you be listening to Warm 106.9 or something right now? Well, think about it. What happens when you close your ears and you close your eyes to sexual abuse? In the studio with me now is Janice Palm, who works with survivors of sexual abuse at Shepherd's Counseling Service. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you.
Come close to that microphone, will you? And Dan Knopfler, who works with sex offenders. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Janice, what happens when we change the radio station and continue to avoid this topic?
Boy, that is a very easy answer. It continues. Sexual abuse continues because there's silence around it.
Dan, you work with offenders. What does our silence mean to this problem?
It splits apart families in the long run.
Yeah. So
it's very hard on everyone.
Let's get into this and what we could possibly do better. First of all, do we change the station because sexual abuse seems both awful and private and unsolvable, Janice?
I think so. You know, I say this not infrequently. If you say the words, "I work with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse," those words together in a sentence bring up a picture nobody wants to look at. There isn't a part of that that we want to see. I think we have a visceral reaction to the whole topic, to thinking that it happens. It is just uncomfortable to think about.
Could it be better if we, what could we do instead of being uncomfortable? Because it just seems intractable.
I think acknowledging, you know, that it happens. The statistics tell us that. For people who are adults now, we know the averages are 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 4 girls have had some experience of sexual abuse before they're 18. That generalizes that averages to 1 in 5.
That's 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 4 girls.
Right.
Dan, why would somebody sexually abuse someone else, especially a young person?
Well, it crosses a continuum. The kids I work with tend to be curious kids. They don't tend to be sort of the deviant, predatory person that you would expect that does this kind of thing. As adults, there's a lot of people who are dissatisfied in their lives and use sex as a way to cope and distract themselves from their life that they really don't like. And it's a really destructive way to cope. But most people, there's an element of that as part of their acting out.
Yeah. Cope and distract. That's a little more complicated than how it's framed, usually.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, before we leave the topic of silence, since we're not being silent now, Janice, this idea, this unwillingness to open our eyes to talk about 1 in 5 young people being a victim of sexual abuse. Will you give me an example of how does that affect your clients? Tell me a story.
Being sexually abused in childhood is really, honestly, a very devastating thing to happen. Children are confused. They don't understand what's happening to them. They're not at a level of sexual development where this fits for them or makes sense for them. You know, there can be an element of fear involved. Often there is, certainly confusion. So, you know, and we also know that kids don't tell. Kids generally don't speak up and say what happened to them because they're afraid and because they're traumatized. When people are traumatized, it's really hard to have words, put the story together, say what happens, and children may simply not have the words to talk about what happened to them because they don't understand it. So it's a secret. And what happens is that the trauma goes inside and people become far less trusting If I thought I could trust the world, if I thought I was safe, and I find out that I'm not safe anymore, well then, who can I trust? It's better not to get close to people. We see a lot of symptoms that are just flat out PTSD. People often wait decades to talk about this, and I think that bears out in the stories we've heard in the Murray situation. These men waited decades to speak up. That's not unusual. And it's usually when life gets too hard, too complicated, can't put relationships together, can't get close to people, or simply, you know, honestly, flashbacks are disturbing my sleep so much I can't hold a job, for instance, then people will reach out and get help. But it causes enormous ripples throughout a person's life.
Janice, you just brought up the case of Seattle's mayor, former mayor now, who denies these allegations, which is part of what we're talking about. Are you comfortable using, as you just did, the name of one person who denies the charges when we're talking about sexual abuse? That he says never happened.
It's so characteristic, I have to say. You know, I don't know. We probably will never know the resolution of this. We may never say, okay, conclusively he did or didn't. Likely we won't. But I have to say that the denial, I didn't do it, flat out, I didn't do it, the discrediting of the victims, saying, look at their lives, they're not credible, this is very, very, very characteristic of abusers. They're trying to distance themselves from what happened to them. They want it not to come out. And so they deny it. And it's very damaging. It's very wounding to people who have been hurt deeply and sexually abused.
Dan, what helpful could come out of the case of Seattle's now ex-mayor?
Well, so my experience starting in the 80s doing this work is that it wasn't unusual that offenders had multiple victims, but we've really come a long way in 30 years. Like, a person with 5, 10, 20 victims is an outlier these days. And so talking about sexual abuse, talking about kids having the right to say, I'm not comfortable with that kind of touching of my body, and really empowering people to take charge of their lives has really changed things. And so the talking helps. The other thing is, and you know, the research regarding people who've been abused is, the more they could talk about what they've had happen to them, the more they're believed, the more they're supported, the better the outcome. So by having this cloud of silence over sexual assault, we're actually making people who've been sexually abused worse. We are exacerbating symptoms that don't have to be exacerbated. We are making their lives much more miserable and difficult. So if we can talk about it, we believe them, we trust that their memories are accurate, we don't discredit them, they have a lot to gain. And they aren't coming in for services 20 years later and have all these destructive and negative things going on in their life.
How do we balance believing accusers with the rights of the accused?
Well, so I think families, you know, can believe a person. That doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a conviction coming down the road. You need children, unless there are really clear ulterior motives, don't lie about these things. They really do not. Like, if there's, you know, the times when there are sometimes false allegations or during really heated custody disputes and things along those lines. But in general, by and large, kids in particular, there's so many negative pressures for saying that this happened, that what was said before is, the reality is most don't tell rather than overreport. Like, those statistics probably grossly underestimate how many people are actually being sexually assaulted. And the reality beyond that is, if it's dad, grandpa, uncle, your favorite neighbor, right, there isn't just... there are so many other consequences, because if dad goes to prison, mom may end up living in the homeless shelter with the kids because he's the primary source of income. And so there's a lot, or grandpa and grandma will never talk to us again, or Uncle Joe is going to have to leave the state or whatever it may be. So the reality that kids falsely report is is really not an accurate thing for the most part.
We're talking with Dan Knopfler, who's a certified sex offender treatment provider in South King County, and Janice Palm, who works with survivors of sexual abuse. Dan, on the offender side, what's one thing we could do to prevent sexual abuse from ever happening? What's something a listener right now who you've made us care, we're still listening, we're still listening to KUOW right now, what can I do?
So draconian laws may feel good in the short term when it comes to people who've committed sexual assault, but the reality is the person least likely to reoffend is a person who has a stable life and a reason to care and a reason not to get back into trouble. So there has to be punishment, but it needs to be balanced with a sense of, like, they need to have a chance to have a life. So they need to have a place to live. They need to have a job. They need to have, again, a reason to live. And if you can just take a tiny step back and not say, you know what, they deserve to be, you know, tossed in the gutter forever, it will help. And the reality is there'll be less sexual assault that occurs because these guys aren't going to go out and hurt someone if they have a life that's worth living.
Okay, two questions on that then. Is there anything we lose by somehow easing up on the hostility, the condemnation that we share of sexual abusers? And number two, is that even realistic? You know, is it realistic for us to not think of sexual abusers as vile? It almost seems hardwired. So there's two questions in there, right? Sometimes societal condemnation serves a purpose. You know what I'm talking about. What
Absolutely.
Do we do about that?
Well, there's a difference between making it clear that something is wrong and there's a consequence for your actions and making them pariahs. Like, there's a huge difference. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have legal consequences, that some should go to prison. All those things are true. But when, you know, our country has a belief about, like, you do your time and then you get a chance to rehabilitate yourself. And so I'm just saying that once people have taking care of that consequence, give them a chance to rehabilitate themselves. And that includes housing, that includes working, that includes having some semblance of an okay life. I mean, I don't think that's an outrageous, you know, request from my standpoint.
Do you have friends who are former sexual abusers? Can you have love for former sexual abusers? I'm just wondering how you process this in your work.
So what people, I think, forget is many times the person who abused someone is very close and dear to them. And many times it's ironic. The person who's been abused may actually be the most forgiving of the offender of anyone, because especially children, they have this remarkable ability to see people as multifaceted, multidimensional people. Mm. You know, Uncle Joe may have been the guy who actually cared the most about this kid and cross that boundary, but at the same time, may have spent the most time, listened the most closely to this person. And so, like, sometimes a person who's been abused may be the most forgiving, and actually their anger may be directed more at peripheral adults in the system who didn't believe them and failed to protect them. Like there's sort of a strange irony sometimes about that.
Yeah, but boy, the person who cared the most crossed the boundary. I mean, so Janice, you work with survivors. Do you disagree with anything that Dan just said, honestly?
I don't. I mean, honestly, this is a very, very, very complex topic, and it's hard to nail it down. You know, we've got humans on both sides of this. We've got humans who are the perpetrators. We've got humans who are the abused. So there's a lot of complexity. And it's true. I think one of the things, and this is goes toward prevention, is understanding that 90% of abusers are known to the child. I think when we think about child sexual abuse, we think about, you know, the guy in the park in the raincoat. And there are some guys in the park in the raincoats, for sure, who are looking to molest children. That's the statistics tell us these are people in a child's life who have made friends with them, have maybe honestly been a good friend to them, taught them how to play basketball, taught them things that they wouldn't have known, cared about them, given them things that they wouldn't otherwise have. We can call this grooming. Yes, it's grooming. But for a child, that really complicates the situation. So these are situations where, you know, in those situations, a child doesn't know. They don't understand, you know, is this person hurting me? Are they helping me? What's going on here? It can take decades to figure that out. So there's a lot of complexity to this.
Janice, do you fault our system, our society, when sometimes you tell somebody and they don't help you? Reporters don't always publish. Prosecutors don't always charge. Caseworkers don't always get involved. You know, does it have to be that way? You could almost call it a conspiracy of silence. No one's guilty, right? But there's the system.
Yeah, we're all guilty of it. It's hard. And to be honest, if you know, for parents, I do a little bit of prevention work, and I tell young parents, you know, it's if your child comes to you and says, you know, Uncle so-and-so touched me, there's going to be a lot going on if you're the parent, because outing this, talking about this is a hard thing to do. It's going to create chasms. It's going to create a lot of trouble in your family. It would be easier to say, oh, he really didn't mean it. And so I do think we need to acknowledge this happens. This causes enormous harm. We need to be talking about it. We need to understand it happens. But we also need probably more compassionate ways of dealing with it when it happens, so that it doesn't need to be such high stakes, such a black and white issue. Abusers need help, definitely. And children need to be safe. There's no question about that.
I think you're telling us listeners right now, be courageous. This hurts. This is scary. You know, you be courageous.
Yeah.
Step up. There's help. There's people who like you who know a lot, right? That, you know, you can learn about this. You can learn how to talk to people. We've got other topics for today, and there's so much here, but Janice, how do you have hope? I can't imagine the stories you hear, the images in your mind. Help us have some hope, if there is.
There is hope, and it is. I mean, this sounds strange, but I feel like I'm sort of on the lucky end of this equation, because by the time people go through what they need to go through in themselves to reach out and ask for help, they know what that means. They know that they're going to be talking about the hardest parts of their life, the most painful things for them. They've already made that decision with themselves, and they ask for help. So I'm on the receiving end of that. And yeah, it is about holding human suffering. And it's very hard sometimes to consider what human beings are capable of doing to other human beings. That's difficult. But I also have this amazingly lucky job of getting to see how when people reach out for help, they get it. They can learn to heal. Their lives get better than they ever thought they could have been before. And all the effort that's gone into coping and keeping this pushed aside now can go into living your life, having vitality, having spontaneity, having creativity, growing relationships that are truly healthy and good. That is absolutely the hopeful part.
Dan, same question to you then as we wrap it up. What gives you hope?
Well, so there's a lot of meaning in what I do, because it's meaningful to feel like I'm part of preventing sexual assault from continuing to occur. And again, similar to people who've been victimized, getting this wound exposed and cleaned and letting it heal, right, is a very gratifying job to be a part of. And sitting with people in their unhappiness and their misery is a difficult job. But, you know, when I go home at the end of the night, I feel good about what I've done. And people do get better. And some of the early statistics in the 80s and 90s about, like, there was, you know, to this day, we're still battling an issue where 80% of these men reoffend. And that's just bogus science. There's actually a lot of really good science that's occurred in the last, and research that's occurred in the last 30 years, that interventions help, and the recidivism rates aren't nearly as horrible and scary as people once thought. So intervention works on both sides of this issue. There's only 100 of me in the state of Washington. There's only 100 of us who do this. And so,
wow.
So I, part of my hope is that I want more people to do the job I do, because the more we have people like me who are willing to work with these men who've made probably the most serious mistake in their life, the less we'll need me down the road. So,
Dan Knopfler, certified sex offender treatment provider in South King County. Janice Palm, therapist and director of Shepherd's Counseling Services. She works with survivors of sexual abuse. I want to thank both of you for coming in, talking about the news that we're all thinking about and the bigger crisis that lays beyond that, whether we want to think about it all the time or not. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much for doing this program.
Thank you very much.
KUOW's The Record continues in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Seattle needs more affordable housing. I think most people agree on that. How Seattle should get affordable housing, that's something people do not agree on. And our next guests are on, you could say, opposite sides of that debate. John Fox with the Seattle Displacement Coalition. Roger Valdez, co-founder of Smart Growth Seattle. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
You disagree, but you've got stuff in common. You've got clear ideas for how we can create a more affordable city, and you've both been insulted because of your ideas at times. We're glad you're here. First of all, am I right? You agree you both want people of all income levels to afford to live in Seattle?
We certainly would agree on that. Absolutely. Maybe our priorities might be a bit different in terms of whether we're more concerned about adding supply at the higher income level or preserving what we've got to begin with and starting from there with the addition of subsidized housing that we need. Roger might disagree, but that's where we part a little company.
Well, we're right into it. Roger, how do you think we should get this more affordable Seattle?
Well, you said something that was interesting. I don't think we need more affordable housing, but we need more housing so that it will be affordable. And I think that's a distinction that is important. And John, I think...
You think more supply will lower the price?
I think what happens is we agree that 0 to 30% of area median income, really truly poor people struggling to get out of poverty, generational poverty, people that don't have a lot of earning potential, those are the folks that need the subsidies. And we'll have better use of our subsidy dollars if we have the market perform and produce more supply, so we have more subsidy to help those poorer people. And John and I actually co-authored a letter to the mayor a few years ago saying, we need to focus on that 0 to 30 for the subsidies, not higher levels of income. And when we don't build market housing, people that make $80,000 are going to qualify for affordable housing, and that's not right. We should be supporting people that are really struggling at the lower end of our economy.
All right, let's break this down into terms even I can understand. John, I took Econ 101. More supply of anything generally means that the price drops. Isn't more building the way to make housing units cheaper?
The only time where that traditional supply-side argument works is indeed in a textbook. In the real world, particularly in a build-up city like Seattle, often the consequence of new development means removal of our existing stock of low-income and affordable housing. Most of the low-income people, those at or below 30% of median, as Roger has pointed out, they don't live in subsidized housing. They depend on a supply of older, affordable brick apartments, many scattered around right here in this neighborhood in the University District. Two-thirds of them are dependent on this naturally occurring supply. Right now, it's open season on that stock. For every one unit of subsidized housing we can create with the levy dollars, the millions we spend, we lose 3 to 4 times that amount as a result of these market forces. So simply unleashing more of that is a blueprint for more displacement, more gentrification.
Roger, so an older apartment was more affordable. Now a shiny new apartment. Those go for more. Doesn't that mean housing got just less affordable?
Well, the numbers don't align with what John is saying. I mean, we've actually produced over the last 20 years something like 40,000 units of housing and only demolished about 5,000. And so that's a huge ratio of new housing to housing that's been knocked down. And it's true there are some smaller, older buildings that have to come down to make way for 60 or 80 apartment units. But we can't, you know, I like to say we don't have a housing crisis, we have a housing shortage. So if we sit on those four units of housing and don't build anything, then we're not going to be able to accommodate the new people coming in. So there is a certain amount of shift at the lower end. But the fact is that on average, if you build more housing for people that have more money, then they're not competing for that older stock.
Yeah, John, the shiny new apartment building might go for more money, but now it's shiny and new, and the other apartment buildings just got older compared to the new stuff, and more is online.
I'm not sure where Roger gets his numbers, but we would firmly disagree with what he's saying. The housing levy, that $290 million, the earlier one from 2005 to 2016, we were able to create 2,100 units of subsidized housing with those millions of dollars. We commit maybe $30, $40 million a year to produce low-income new subsidized housing. We lost during that decade, 2005 through 2015, 7,200 units of low-income affordable rentals to demolition. There are applications pending for the removal of another 1,290 units of existing housing to make way for luxury apartments. That does not include when you upzone an area, it drives up property values, which immediately translate into increased rents. That speculation forces, on average, another 1,000 or more people from their homes due to those speculative forces.
Okay, stepping away from the numbers, which are important, and we've laid out some of that, for a moment, I want to talk about a feeling and an aesthetic and what it's like to live someplace. On Facebook, listener Sarah says, "I'm starting to not recognize my beloved city." We've heard that a lot. Roger, what do you say to a Seattleite who says, "Development has ruined my community, trees and apartments gone, replaced by hulking buildings, clogging our streets with privileged people who don't want to live with the kind of folks who made this the place we love"?
Well, if Sarah was living in Seattle in 1950, she wouldn't recognize it either. So the city's going to change, and it's good that it changes. I want people to be able to move here on their last tank of gas with a busted taillight on their car and be able to get rid of the car and move into a decent apartment and live in this city right next down the street from a millionaire that just sold their company. In order for us to do that, in order for us to make things affordable for people that are here now and people that are coming, we've got to build more housing. And that means that things are going to change. And it means that there's going to be a little bit more traffic and annoying things and noise, and things are going to look different. But that's our way of making room at the table for those new people, putting some new chairs up at the table so they can get access to the bounty that we have in this community.
John, you wouldn't be human if you weren't resistant to change, especially if, and I'm not talking about you necessarily, but if you've got a single family home that you like and it's worth something, you like things the way they are, that is human. But, you know, as Roger's saying, cities change. Why are you entitled to a city that doesn't change?
I think let's be a bit real here. From the average person's perspective who lives in Seattle, from anyone's perspective who looks at this objectively, we're drowning in new construction. This isn't about a case about no growth versus a little growth. We are drowning in new construction. Normally, we average 2,000 to 3,000 new units a year. We're building at 8,000 units per year. There are applications pending for another 25,000 housing units. There are not enough permit specialists at the permit counter to process all the permits that we are seeing. And we are exceeding the new demand created by the influx of new residents. The amount of housing development since 2012 has been more than enough to meet this influx of new residents. My point is, before we go further with this construction binge, and the mayor's upzone plan will greatly accelerate growth, we must first put in place mechanisms to prevent the continued accelerated loss of low-income housing, require developers to replace one-for-one what they remove at comparable price, and put in place strategies to preserve our historic structures, to preserve our dwindling older growth evergreen tree canopy, historic buildings. Everything that we value in this city is being placed at risk by it. It's a question of managing growth, not no growth versus growth and responsible growth, and we don't have that right now.
Roger, you suggested that Seattleites who oppose density are like President Trump. Will you explain?
Well, I mean, I think we have a lot of, you know, we've seen these signs that have gone up around, we believe in science and we believe in all this stuff, and these yard signs because people were outraged about Trump. But yet, you know, what John is saying is simply not the case. I mean, there's a lot of construction going on because a lot of people want to live here, and our people are trying to build housing as fast as they can. And he's right. The permit counter is overflowing because the city doesn't have the adequate resources because they're overregulating the housing market. There's so many things that these plans reviewers have to review for and design review and everything else that the production's not keeping up with the demand. So
how is this Trump-like?
Well, what's happening is the neighborhoods don't want anybody else to move in. They have equity in their homes. So the fewer houses that are being built mean the value of those single-family homeowners, their value of their properties going up. So they say they want more immigrants and they want to help the DACA folks out, but yet at the same time they're saying, well, we don't want you to move to Seattle because we don't want to build any more apartments because we're drowning in construction, as John says. Well, we're not drowning enough. We need more. If we're going to have thousands of immigrants come to our community, where are they going to live? They can't live in the housing that John claims is being knocked down because there's already people living there.
There are parts of Seattle where the word Trump is an insult, and I get emails from people who either support or oppose density and upzoning, and they often insult the other group. Some of that's happening on our Facebook page right now. Why is this so personal?
First off, those who use the term NIMBY or, again, accuse neighborhoods of putting up a wall or being Trump-like, it's ironic. Wallingford, where these signs are up opposing the mayor's housing plan, significant upzones are planned, there were precincts throughout that district that did not vote for Trump at all. There were no votes for Trump. It's one of the most, they voted for Bernie Sanders. But the point is,
well, Roger's saying the instinct overlaps.
The point is, these are insults to marginalized communities whose primary concern is they care about managed and reasonable growth and want measures first put in place to preserve the values that brought them here in the first place. The notion.
So you don't find any truth to the accusation of, I guess the NIMBY, the not in my backyard, I've got mine and I'm comfortable and I don't like change. I've been doing work in the community for almost
40 years, yeah. Bill. A large portion of our work is mostly around housing preservation strategies, housing and homeless advocacy, but we've worked with hundreds of neighborhood activists. There are over 100 community organizations in this city. With few exceptions, the leadership, the participation in these groups come from caring, hardworking people who simply want to ensure a livable and affordable city. Wallingford, with its activism, joined us to ensure displacement strategies were built into the mayor's housing plan. Wallingford, the bastion of NIMBYism.
Yeah. Look, well, Roger, just a second, I want to be fair here, because if any group gets insulted, it's developers. There's in the Seattle glossary, developer can equal evil, and I know developers donate to your nonprofit, and you have an interest in advocating for more building. But is it also fair to say, if you want somebody whose interests are your interests, it ain't developers?
Well, John talks about marginalized. A person that is living, say, an older couple with no kids at home, living on a 5,000 square foot lot in Wallingford in $1 million home, that is not a marginalized individual. And those are the individuals that drive that agenda that say, no, we don't want an apartment 3 or 4 blocks away. So our guys just work hard every day and women to produce housing that will meet that demand for those new people coming in. It's the people in Wallingford who are living in those basically $1 million or some of them more than that houses that they bought 20 or 30 years ago that are opposing the new person that's coming in with a $40,000 a year job or 2 jobs and saying, no, we don't want those apartments here because they're going to displace someone. So it doesn't make any sense. So the truth is that our folks are producing the housing that is needed, and we're trying to do that. But we're thwarted by the folks that are millionaires in Wallingford claiming to be marginalized. It's really absurd.
John, we don't have to get at the motives of either people with million-dollar homes or developers. What's so beyond the names? What do you think is the bigger? We're almost out of time. So what's your larger message? What is this all this disagreement about upzoning and building? What is this really about in your estimation? What do you want to say?
It's about putting in place first measures to prevent the continued accelerated loss of the existing stock of low-income and affordable housing. It's about putting in place measures to preserve our tree canopy, to preserve our historic structures, to build in mechanisms to ensure that when growth occurs, it reinforces, not destroys, what makes this city livable and affordable. We have more than enough zone capacity right now for 220,000 housing units. The Growth Management Act has prescribed over the next 20 years a target of only 70,000 units. The mayor, 100,000 units. We're overzoned. We have almost two and a half times the capacity we need. We don't, this obsession with going into single-family neighborhoods, 25% of single-family homes are occupied by renters, large families, low-income, disproportionately people of color, larger families. You upzone single-family neighborhoods, it's a blueprint for more displacement and more gentrification.
Okay, finally,
property values.
Roger, couldn't we keep Seattle more or less as we love it, and we're building all this transit? Let people live other places if Seattle is going to be unaffordable.
I'll make a deal with John. We won't touch the single family if he lets us build everything as much as we want in those areas that are already zoned multifamily. His folks oppose that. So this isn't about encroaching on single family. This is about, you know, the fact that we built a $1 billion infrastructure of light rail, and John's folks come out and oppose transit-oriented development around light rail stations.
If Roger supports,
and those aren't even single-family.
Roger supports one-for-one replacement, requiring developers to pay impact fees to first preserve older growth tree canopy and build those, put those measures in place so that when that density occurs in those areas, we'd talk.
We got to talk later because I can't believe our show is three quarters over and we're going to tackle Buddhism. John Fox with Seattle Displacement Coalition, Roger Valdez of Smart Growth Seattle. We got to talk this out, and thank you for doing it.
I'll stick around for the Buddhism.
Excellent. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for all your ideas and comments. The conversation continues on Facebook. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. If any group of people is peaceful, you'd think it would be Buddhists. And yet this week in the Buddhist-majority country of Myanmar, minority Muslims are being driven from their homes. Buddhists are carrying out revenge killings and ethnic cleansing. Obviously, I'm not blaming an entire religion, but can any religion change who humans are fundamentally? My next guest is Pulitzer Prize finalist Robert Wright, whose latest book is Why Buddhism is True. Welcome, Robert.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, I am not saying Buddhism is uniquely violent. And of course, the killing in Myanmar involves politics and power. But still, why hasn't Buddhism enlightened us yet?
Well, my book, first of all, is about what is sometimes called secular Buddhism. So when I say in the title Why Buddhism is True, I'm not talking about the supernatural part, reincarnation, and so on. And one common misunderstanding about Buddhism in the West, precisely because so many Westerners focus on a kind of secular version of Buddhism, is they think that Buddhists in Asia are people who don't believe in God and do meditate. It's almost the opposite. Lay Buddhists in Asia, by and large, don't meditate. They do believe in deities and so on. And my book is largely about the benefits of meditation, especially when placed in the context of Buddhist philosophy. Now, people who meditate can certainly misbehave, and it's not a guaranteed way to become a better person, although I think that it can help. But in any event, what's going on in Myanmar is not an example of people immersed in Buddhist meditation being horrible people anyway.
Okay, your book could have been called Why Meditation Works, but you invoke Buddhism in the title, but you're not saying karma and reincarnation. You're not saying that's true.
I'm not saying that's true. And the reason I wouldn't have called it Why Meditation Works is because I'm making a more ambitious claim, then that it will make you happier or can make you happier. I think it can do that. But I also think that it can bring you what you could call a valid happiness. And here I'm referring to what I think of as kind of the core of the Buddhist claim, which is that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is that we don't see the world clearly. We have illusions about ourselves, about other people, about the world broadly. So the idea is that you can, in principle, kill three birds with one stone. You see the world more clearly. You come closer to the truth. You become happier. And you also approach moral truth because you can become a better person. Again, it's not a guaranteed outcome from meditation per se, but I think if you put meditation in the context of Buddhist philosophy, which I try to do in the book, people are more likely to become better people as well as happier people.
Well, first of all, delusion, I can be happy and deluded at the same
you
time,
could
right?
Be. I would call that happiness, but not valid happiness. That's exactly the distinction I'm talking about.
Okay, so that pint of ice cream I'm enjoying right now, and deluding myself as to whether it's going to be good for me is not valid?
It would be shown, if you think it's going to make you enduringly happy, it would be shown eventually to have been wrong.
Right.
I mean, that's not the kind of misperception I'm most concerned about.
Yes.
I'm most concerned about a happiness that comes at the expense of other people and is reconciled with the mistreatment of other people. So when I say seeing things clearly, I'm especially focusing on seeing other people clearly.
Okay, well, let's take the example of the mistreatment of other people. Let's take the ethnic cleansing I mentioned. Would it be consistent with Buddhism to say, I don't want to kill anyone, but everyone dies of something, why be upset about it? I thought that was kind of part of Buddhism, that to not be outraged about if people are mistreated. Even saying they're mistreated is kind of a moral judgment that I thought Buddhism was not
yeah,
about.
Yeah, no, I think Buddhism certainly involves, there's no doubt that one of the core values of Buddhism is concern for the well-being of sentient life generally, certainly including humans. So being indifferent to the death of people is simply not consistent with Buddhist values.
But isn't that a religious tenet, that whether you ought to be concerned?
It's a moral philosophy.
I mean, so maybe I have it wrong.
Buddhism can be ethical. It just doesn't involve any supernatural claims.
Because when I imagine secular Buddhism and what little I know about it, and I've tried some meditation, I imagine separating myself from all kinds of judgments that ping around in my meat skull, and those could be conventionally moral judgments.
It is certainly the case that becoming less judgmental in many senses is from early on an important part of meditative progress. And I think one of the moral benefits is being less judgmental of people. And there is a concern sometimes expressed that if you carry that logic far enough, you will become nihilistic. I mean, you'll become the kind of person that you're describing.
That's what I'm asking.
That's an interesting philosophical question, and I address it in what may be the world's longest footnote in my book. And the reason I put it in a footnote is because I do think it's an essentially academic question. Almost no one gets so far down the meditative path that they are in any danger of becoming truly indifferent to everything going on in the world. I think for most of us, like me, the problem is more that your concern for things in the world, including like your passion for whatever kind of activism you have, social justice, whatever, can be so intense that it's counterproductive. And in fact, I see a certain amount of that in American politics today. I started a website called mindfulresistance.net because I think I'm on the anti-Trump side of the tribal divide, although I think both sides could stand to meditate, including mine. And in fact, that's part of what the site is about. I think there's a certain amount of overreaction to Trump that kind of plays into his hands. And one thing, skillful meditation does is allow you to continue to pursue the goals that you think are important without the emotional reactivity that can get in the way of reaching them.
So overall, you think I have the impression that emotional reactivity can push us out into the streets to agitate for change.
It can.
Whereas
and
could it be complacent.
But it can also lead people to say things like, yeah, punch a Nazi, which I think is counterproductive, and support the initiation of violence, not just violence in self-defense, but the initiation of violence by Antifa, which I am almost completely confident is a stupid move tactically. And it's that same emotional outrage that supports what I think of as bad tactics. You're right. It's a tough line to hoe, but I think it's essential that we try to not lose sight of the moral values that inspire us, and yet not let our passion for them get us to, you know, fail to serve them.
Robert Wright is the author of the new book, Why Buddhism is True. I think you said that Buddhism can help us with our delusions, a way out of our delusion. What is our delusion?
Oh, well, there's various kinds. We tend to, psychology is showing that actually we are much less, the conscious self is much less in control of our actions than we really think of it as being. We tend to think we're morally better than we are. I mean, more than half of the people, if you ask, will say, I'm better than average morally. Well, that can't be. Somebody's wrong here. And that's a tendency you find around the world. So we delude ourselves about how noble and good we are. Another kind of delusion I went on my first meditation retreat. I'm like walking through the woods. I see a kind of weed I've spent a lot of time trying to kill because it infested my lawn. And I go, wait a second, why have I been trying to kill this weed? It looks just as beautiful as everything else. And at one level, that's a trivial observation. Weed is a human-imposed category, and I was finally transcending it. But it was also a deep perceptual shift. And this, for those Buddhist aficionados out there, I think illustrates a concept called emptiness, which means not imposing a sense of essence on things, not artificially letting our perception of a weed be infused by essence of weed. Now, in that context, the context of weeds, this is not morally consequential, but when you bring it out into the human realm and people start seeing essence of a particular group, a particular ethnic group, particular racial group, or even a particular person whom they size up too quickly and put so firmly in the enemy or rival camp that they cannot judge them objectively, and in that way, you know, come to not even serve their own kind of goals, then it's a big problem. And that is actually getting past that kind of thing illustrates this very deep Buddhist concept of emptiness. And one point in my book is that people who are meditating for what may seem like fundamentally therapeutic reasons, getting over stress, anxiety, which is a valid use of it, are closer than they may think to a kind of a deeper philosophical and spiritual exploration. And I've tried to provide the kind of background that will help with that.
You're reminding me, I recommend Googling cognitive distortions, because just the list, and you will recognize yourself, the list of the things we do that, from catastrophizing, confirmation bias, mind reading, black and white thinking, it's a list of how you don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. There are all these biases. Confirmation bias means, you know, seeing and accepting information consistent with your views, rejecting or not even seeing evidence inconsistent. The current incarnation of that is spreading fake news. Now, we've all done it. I've retweeted things that I did not examine sufficiently, and they turned out to be misleading. And if you ask why did I do it, it boils down to a feeling. It felt good to spread news that reflects unfavorably on the enemy tribe, which in my case would be Trump supporters, and favorably on my tribe. But one way I think but first of all, I don't think that helps our side when we do that. That feeds Trump's narrative that, you know, everyone hates me and they're out to get me and they're spreading these lies about me. And I think mindfulness meditation, the kind I focus on in the book, can be helpful here because it can make you more aware of how feelings are pushing you and pulling you in subtle ways you had not even appreciated and influencing your very cognition and perception. It doesn't mean neutralizing all feelings. It just means taking a look at them and deciding which ones you want to follow.
I'm already talking about this stuff with my daughter, about the unhelpful thoughts that are pinging around in her mind. You know, so I'm way into this, but Robert, I find meditation hard to stick with. Why doesn't it feel better right away?
You and I may be more closely related than we realize, because it was exactly my situation. I have a limited attention span. I'm not a picture of emotional stability. These things work against meditation. I personally had to finally go to a 1-week silent meditation retreat. It just never worked. Now, happily, And then it did click, and I had a lot of experiences that convinced me to sustain the practice. Happily, most people are not as bad at meditating as I am, and they can try things like meditation apps, you know, Headspace, 10% Happier, various apps. They can look up. In Seattle, there are a number of local communities. I spoke on Vashon Island last night to a Zen group. You know, you can find a meditation community. There are online teachers and so on. I recommend retreats for anybody who can spare a week. Yeah. And pick out a good one, because they can really be transformative. And there, it's like extreme sports for the mind. You know, it's like a lot of great parts, some problematic parts probably, but even those can be deep and illuminating. And, you know, if you got the time, do it.
Would more Americans be into Buddhism if you dropped the Sanskrit terms, the Dharma and the Nirvana, that just get mangled anyway? And the outfits,
and if they better understood them. Like the idea that the Buddha said that life is suffering. Well, first of all, he didn't quite say that, but he said there's a lot of suffering. But if you look at what the term dukkha means, suffering is one plausible translation. Another plausible one is unsatisfactoriness. In other words, and this makes total sense in terms of natural selection. I emphasize evolutionary psychology in the book because I think our evolution explains why we have the kinds of minds that the Buddha kind of seems to have accurately diagnosed. But, you know, we are built, animals are built to be recurringly dissatisfied, so they will keep pursuing the goals that got our ancestors' genes into the next generation. You know, food, sex, status, whatever. We're designed to always want a little more, even when it's not in our interest. It's not in maybe the planet's interest. It's no longer in the interest of the species, and so on. So I think in some cases, it helps to actually look at the original terms and get clear on the breadth of their meaning. I tried to speak in the book in plain English, by and large.
I want to meditate on the fact that we're about out of time, because I want to be okay with that, and I'm not right now. But we're talking.
I can help. I'll give you counseling afterwards.
Will you? Thank you. This is Robert Wright. The book is Why Buddhism is True. You're reading in Seattle?
Elliott
I know
Bay.
You were at the Zen Garden on Vashon, where that's over. Elliott Bay tonight. Okay, good. It's been great to talk with you. I know in a compressed amount of time, but I don't know if you can tell, but I'm a big believer. I'm a fan of yours. I'm a believer in this work. It's not easy for me, but it's important. So thanks for coming in and talking
with
us. I won't give up.
Okay.
Robert Wright, thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW is The Record on Twitter @KUOW. Thanks for joining us on Facebook. Talk to you tomorrow.